From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 1. Quintuple Homicide, where Bob gives us a 30,000-foot view of the brand new case that we're going to be working on this season. Two crime scenes, one person, false confessions. There's a lot to get into. We, of course, had a ton of listener interaction for this first episode. Have a feeling there are going to be a lot of things that you will say, hold on to your hat, it's coming. But yeah, really looking forward to getting into this conversation. We are, unfortunately, sans Zach this week. He is on assignment, so we will do our best to represent him in his absence. And before we officially begin, Bob, do we have any housekeeping?
Yeah, a couple things. One, I know one of the questions was that wanted to know about the case documents. They are up now on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. If you go to the Season 17, the Chris Bynum case, you'll see the case documents there. That delay was 100% my fault. The way that we put those up through a Google Doc or a Google Drive. And I got them all together and was going to put them in the Google Drive and did that and forgot about the fact that the website has to be updated for you to get to the Google Drive.
Ah.
So
I had
to and thank you very much to Katie Ross, who does our website. She was on it like yesterday. I was like, oh, shit, Katie, I have to update the website. And she knocked it out in like an hour. So they are up. Also, big shout out to Valeria Martinelli. She added a few things. Of course, she is, as she says, the newspaper and map queen. Found some newspaper articles and created some maps that I was planning on working on today that she had already found, and I stole them from Valeria and put them up on the website too. So there's a good chunk there for episode one. It's mostly photos, not a lot of documents, because we really didn't get into any details yet. You know, that was just, this case was, as you heard, there's a lot to unpack. It's very complicated.
Okay, great. And before we get into that, I just have one little tiny piece of my own housekeeping that's listener related. As you were talking about all of the wonderful listeners who help us remember that we need to post documents, and people like Katie who are making it happen, Valeria as well. I just wanted to very quickly acknowledge, because I didn't say it in the pre-show, that I met listener Jennifer P. in Dallas at a convention I was at recently, and she is so wonderful, and I just wanted to make sure I gave her a quick shout out because she is such a supporter and a fan and is doing really good work in her own work life on behalf of Truth and Justice. So thank you, Jennifer.
Excellent. Only other thing I want to mention is one thing we've been finding out, because there's been a few episodes where we're like, man, we're just not getting a whole lot of questions for the follow-ups.
Right.
I finally started looking at the insights on Facebook, and their algorithm, whatever they are doing in the fan page, it's not showing the follow-up post to people.
Yeah.
So last week I had put the post up. There's 15,000 people in that group if you're not in there.
Yeah.
And it's called the Official Truth and Justice Podcast Fans Page. There's others that are imposters. That's the one. Official Truth and Justice Podcast Fans Page. But there's 15,000 people in there. We put the post up, we pin it to featured, and last week it had showed it to 153 people.
Not helpful.
It's like 1% of the people in there. This week, even after I tagged everyone in the group, and it still only showed it to 300 people. So somebody had asked, like, why am I in? They finally found it and said, why am I not seeing this? So if you want to interact with the follow-up, and we encourage all of you, ask questions, make comments. It helps. That's how this crowdsourcing things work, is getting that interaction between us. If you, at the very least, by Monday evening, it'll be up. If you go to the fan page and just go to the featured section, it will always be in the featured section.
That's so if it's not the only showing reason it I to ever you, see it.
Yeah. If it's not showing it to you in your feed, just go to the featured section, and that's where you'll find it. I don't know what to do differently. I don't know if I have to put a picture or me singing and dancing or something in there to show it to people.
Well, Amy in the chat just pointed out they want you to have to pay money to boost it, which is pretty
insane,
crummy.
In a private group where everybody has crummy. Subscribed to the group because they want to see the content.
Correct.
So with that being said, I dropped a lot on you guys this week.
You did.
I'll tell you, that was a difficult episode to write for Eric and I both, because as you guys heard, there's so much there. There's so many different moments in time you can choose. So we decided to go just from the trial testimony to give you guys a picture, because the first thing we need to do is understand the basics of the case. And that was what we were trying to do here. It's interesting too, because I didn't mention it in the episode. I think I've talked about it before, but this case was brought to us by Dr. Nikki Jackson. If you guys remember back in, I think it was like January, Eric and I went to her offices and talked to her and Timmy at Purdue University. And she is the one that, one of the reasons for that trip was she wanted to pitch this case to us. So of course, you know, I put that out and some of Chris's lawyers and Nikki are like, oh, what about this? What about this? What about this? And I'm super excited with it because, you know, when you have all these people that know the case so well that have been working on it for years, they're like, there's this detail, this detail, this detail. It's like, listen, this is not a podcast where we're going to tell the story in one episode. That was just scratching the surface. Like all the details are to come. So they're all, I was talking to Nikki today. Everybody's super excited about digging into the details. So with that being said, Janet, I know you've got a bunch of notes. What'd you think of that? I didn't even send you a preview this week. You had to listen with everybody else.
I did have to listen with everybody else. Yeah, I actually got up early because I was doing a convention on Sunday and I got up early so that I could listen to the episode before I went into the con. Yeah, I mean, I like many, many listeners, a ton of engagement, as I said, even with the issue with getting it out in front of eyes, that should tell you how much people are ready to dig in, that we got so many questions. Many, many people, and I probably will cut, I'll just omit the portion of your wonderful post where you say stuff like, you'll probably answer this, or I'm probably getting ahead of the game here, but because everyone like me has had the same response, which is 1,000 questions, knowing that it's probably all coming, but sort of wanting to put those questions out there in advance. And as we talked about on the pregame, sometimes that's helpful for you because every once in a while it might flag something where you're like, oh, I should make sure to address that in the next episode or the episode after or whatever, if it hasn't been. So I'm all in. I'm totally fascinated. I mean, I knew a touch about this case beforehand. I mean, because I had gotten a little bit of information from you beforehand, but nothing enough to not kind of blow me away with this first thing. The first thing I'm going to say is I'm very interested in how the clip you played that you did with your interview with Amanda Knox, where she's kind of describing you, unless I'm mistaken, you chose something very specific to describe. We all have talked about false confessions, and I just thought it was very, very interesting that you elected to play exactly what you did. And we didn't get any comments on this, so I know I'm safe to bring it up and I'm not stepping on anyone's toes. But that really stood out to me. It was like, okay, is he giving us hints about maybe what was that something was going on that was unusual? There's something here that it was important for you to have us remember that Amanda said something about like a psychological opening or something like that. Is that fair to say without giving too much away?
You're correct.
Okay.
That was one thing Erica was tasked with last week was there's a very specific set of circumstances that, you know, I told her to go back through Amanda's interview and capture. And I talked to just, you know, like when Amanda and I were in the interview, I told her that we need to get a piece to use for this episode.
So
she knew that. But then when we did the interview, when we got done, you know, she was like, okay, you know, what do you want to ask me about Chris's case? And I had it in my mind. I'm like, you in just very real general context covered exactly what I want. So I'm just going to pull that. So you'll see, like, I wanted you to hear from someone else, you know, how these things happen, what sets of circumstances can lead to these false confessions happening.
Gotcha.
But yeah,
gotcha.
Very, very astute. You picked up on that.
I think that I am going to hold on to the rest of my questions and fold them in, as I'm sort of hitting the listeners' questions about, because some of them can kind of be connected to questions other people had. So let's start with this piece from Lilius. Again, imagining this will be answered, but do we know whether either of the two ladies who were victims and discovered in the park, Elizabeth and Sheila, do you know who was fully naked opposed to partially clothed? Lilius is very anxious to dig in to discover how they were found, what may have happened, what that tells us about the scene and what that tells us about the victimology, helps us see if like maybe one was more personal than the other or something like that.
Yeah. So I do know. Yes. But that's as again, like I said, I was talking to Dr. Jackson about this, too. It's like that's the broad view. And then, and again, as you guys know, all of you listeners know, you've been doing this with me for 17 seasons. You know, we're going to get to it. First episodes are always like this, but now we're going to start moving in piece by piece. So there will be an episode soon, very soon, where we're going to dig into specifically just that crime scene and go through all of those details. Because as you guys know, and for anybody that, any of you that are, because I know there are a lot of new people listening to this season who aren't, you know, longtime Truth and Justice listeners, that's how our process works. It's been incredibly effective over the years is, you know, we take a case and instead of looking at just the big picture, week by week, we take one small piece of it and we dig into every little detail. Sometimes we bring in experts when we need experts. Sometimes we just analyze it. Sometimes you all are the experts. That's the crowdsourcing element, where we put all this information out there and then we break the case down like that over the course of an entire season. And that methodology is what causes us to find things that other people have not found before. I already had a situation like this come up just from the first step. Well, I was actually writing the second episode, but I was talking to somebody from the legal team about a particular document. And I was like, this should be here. Where's this? And then he was looking for it. And he was like, that's not in there. That's never been in the file. It's not part of the discovery. And, you know, in our conversations, I was like, well, I think we're doing pretty good because we're one episode in and we've already identified a major, you know, a major issue, like something that should be in the file that's not there and the reasons why it should be. So that's how the process works. So for anybody that again is brand new to our process, that's like listening to this now and is like, man, I'd listen to this follow up just for them to tell me, I'll tell you later. They won't all be like that. But that's why, because we're going to dig very deeply into everything. And one thing, it can be a little bit frustrating, but what I do is I don't give you guys a whole lot of information beyond what we're talking about this week, because I want you focused, because you, the listener, are a big part of this process and helping us figure it out. And if I throw out, here's the whole trial transcript, then everybody's scattered around all over the place, as opposed to this way, every week, everybody's focused in on one thing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think, again, if you're a new listener, sometimes these first couple of follow-ups are just a good thing to kind of recognize, like, okay, so this listener has reminded us to keep our eyes open, our ears out for this thing as the case unfolds. Like, here's a good thing to put a pin in that, you know, and to really listen with that critical ear when the episodes that pertain to these kinds of questions come out. So great question. Yeah, certainly a good other question from Kelsey, inquiring about any assault, evidence of assault, like sexual assault, stuff like that. I'm sure we'll be getting into that. But Kelsey, great question.
And real quick, before we move on, just to add to what you were saying a minute ago, and that's what Jan and I were talking about this before we started the recording. Sometimes one of the elements that people don't think of that are of crowdsourcing that helps us so much is a lot of times you guys might ask a question that I don't have the answer to or I'm not prepared to do it yet, but you... It's happened many, many times over many, many seasons where somebody asks a question and it triggers something where it's like, I don't know the answer to that, but we should know the answer to that. And
sure.
A lot of times that question you asked leads us down an investigative path that we hadn't thought of before. So that's part of why we go through the process.
Definitely.
And yeah, as Janet said, as far as the sexual assault, we're gonna dig very deeply into every detail of that crime scene coming up.
Got it. Another one like that, a little bit of Valeria says, did anyone ask Michelle whether there was anything in particular that made her worry and start phoning at around 1 a.m. looking for Sheila and Elizabeth, rather than just thinking they'd met another friend and decided to stay out, be back in the morning in time for her to get to work, something like that? Was there any other kind of reason she worried? Maybe did she know more than she told police? And have you been in contact with her?
I have not been in contact with her yet. And for that one, based from what I've read, what I've kind of inferred from it is I think a big part of it was actually her keys situation, because that's mentioned a couple times in the police report and then again in the trial testimony. So like I said, so she gave the key, the house key to get back in. They were just going to the liquor store, so they were only going to be gone for, you know, 15, 20 minutes or something. Well, then she gets up in the middle, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, they're still gone. Obviously, she's wondering where they're at, but she's also, because remember, she didn't call the police at 1 a.m. She started calling all the other friends. And so kind of, and this is just kind of my inference from that, but I think that it was of like, okay, are they coming back? They have my car keys. I have to go to work in the morning. Like, where are they? So I think that is probably what prompted it. And then in the morning, once they didn't show up, and she even says at trial, you know, that on top of the fact that she didn't know where they were, but they also had her car keys and she was stranded because of it. So I think that was one of the things that was weighing on her mind.
Got it. Garrett says, other than the report of gunshots being heard around 1:30 a.m., what other indications are there that the murders of Sheila and Elizabeth occurred first? What evidence do the police cite that points to a time that's later than the murders of Anthony, Angela, and Suzanne?
So one thing I want to clarify is I mentioned in the episode that the state's theory was that the murders happened in that order, even though the evidence seems to contradict it. I want to be clear about this, and I did that kind of on purpose because I'll explain here in a second. When I say the state's theory, that wasn't the state's theory at trial. They didn't present that at trial as that they were flip-flop. They presented it at trial as the murders at the park happened and then the murders at the house happened.
Okay.
The reason I say the state's theory, and this is just a little bit of foreshadowing for you. I mentioned Chris gave a couple of statements and those statements had narratives, and then the narratives, which made no sense, kept changing when the police kind of changed their theory. So in one of Chris's first statements, the whole narrative focused around the murders at the house happening and then leaving and then the murders at the park happening. And so the little, I guess, a little bit of sleight of hand in the way that I word that was for you to be like, well, that's clearly not true. Where did that come from in his statement? Unless that's what was fed to him based on the theory that the police had at the time. So I want to be clear about that. That by trial, the state was very clear that it happened the other way around, but that's not how things started out.
Which is familiar to anyone who's followed Adnan's case, which is this idea of kind of being able to point to police interference and influence with Jay Wilde's stories. You can sort of trace where the police thought the case was going by what they had Jay focusing on, right? I mean,
yeah,
there's a similarity there. And you mentioned, I don't know, I mean, you also mentioned a star witness that changed his stories three times. Is there a second person that you can sort of trace that same activity with other than Chris?
Well, that star witness is Larry Brooks, the 12-year-old.
Oh, so that's, okay, so that's Larry. Gotcha.
Yeah, but yeah, and so, and he, yeah, I mean, he just... We'll get to it, but he essentially later just says exactly where those stories came from.
Got it. Okay, well.
Which we'll get into. Yeah.
The only other thing, so I'll just add to that in terms of like the ballpark crime scene. This is neither here nor there for the most part, but I just thought it was interesting. This is such a kind of a side part of the narrative in your first episode, but I'm curious and interested in the whole, like where the car was and the trail leading into the woods. And I don't know, I just always think, I guess I'm interested in a dog like barking at an empty car and I always think that's kind of odd when people are like, I was walking my dog and my dog started barking, but it's not barking at a live human person. I just don't have a dog that, I don't think I have a dog that would alert to a situation. I mean, dogs are very sensitive. Again, I'm not questioning the witness at all, but I'm just always interested when it's like, this was, you know, I noticed that something was off, but it's not that it was a suspicious person lurking or anything. It was just a physical object, but my dog had this big reaction. So I went in to see why he had that reaction. I'm just always interested in that because I think that happened with the case, the Scottish case, right? Where there was that we covered where it was like the dog sensed something and that prompted someone to go over a wall that they wouldn't have otherwise gone.
Yeah.
I just, in my experience, my dogs have been extraordinary and extremely smart. I've just never been in a situation where they've sort of done the Lassie thing. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to dismiss it. I'm just saying that always sticks out to me. I'm always like, huh, wow, okay.
Yeah, well, and I think there's a lot going on there too, as far as the scene. So when we get to that piece of it, we'll go over like the layout. Like it wasn't a real long distance. There was a pretty significant, if you go on the website and see the picture, pretty significant blood trail. So the smell of blood is something that I think could, and then the bodies were not far from there. It wasn't woods. It was like, it's a baseball park.
Right.
It was, it's not anymore. And there was like a trail that goes like along the side, more like a road that goes along the side of the baseball park. And then there was just like some bushes off to the side where they were at. So they, you know, the dog could have been smelling the people, could have been smelling the blood. Maybe the dog that, you know, people's memories change. It could have been, you know, not happen. And then also, you know, I mean, a lot of people's dogs won't freeze and go on full point when they smell a bunny, you know, like right. Everybody's you know, like, yeah. Depends on the dog too. Like my dog, if he goes out and he smells anything weird, he's going to sit there and stand there like a statue, like an idiot.
Yeah.
That's just what he's trained to do. You right. Know? Yeah. So I don't know. And it's, again, it's always possible that the dog barking thing doesn't have, because that's how memories work, right? Your brain's not, it's recording, but it's not paying attention to minor details in just normal everyday thing, right? So you're walking your dog, you're not paying attention. It's very routine. And then, holy crap, I remember, like, there's blood. Why is this car here? There's something weird. And at some point the dog's barking. Like when you try to rewind that and replay it in your mind, your brain tends to like start to fill in these gaps and like, how did this actually come about? And it could be as simple as the dog just was barking, or it could be as simple as the dog was barking. That would, you know, that's what got my attention, even though maybe that wasn't really the case, that the dog barked later. Who knows?
And I guess the end of that was like to say, all that to say, maybe I wonder if there was someone lurking near the car that like, you know, the witness didn't see. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, the car was out in the open. The car was white out in the open. Yeah.
All right. So let's move on to a quick question about the house. Ginny says, I'm a bit confused and maybe I missed it, but how could Larry wake up to hear arguing in the home earlier in the night, but not wake up at the sound of gunshots? But didn't he wake up to the sound of gunshots?
Yeah, I try to make that as cohesive as I could.
Knowing that it ends up being all over the place.
Well, yeah. So like one day I should share with you guys the notes, the aside notes that Erica writes in the outlines, which she's done the research, She'll write the, and this is one of those instances where she like writes like, here's the quote, here's Larry saying this, that he fell asleep right after this. And then it'll be like, well, what the fuck? I guess never mind, because now he says this. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what, and like what, so.
But this, that was just his testimony in court. So even within the one version
just
of the story
testimony.
In court, it contradicted itself.
Yeah. So he says that he woke up and heard the arguing during the first trip. When the two guys were there, right? And then he says that he fell asleep before the people left.
Right.
But then in the next couple questions, he's talking about what everyone's doing after, you know, when the people left or after the people left. And then the phone call with Willie, I don't remember if I said this in the episode or not, but Anthony Jeffers, everybody knows him as Amp. As his
right.
Name. So he always talks about, yeah. So, you know, here's Amp talking to his brother in the other room. So it's very confusing because it's like you said you were, and then he said that he woke up to the sound of gunshots. But then later he talks about like hearing the voices before the gunshots. Hmm. But in one version, he said he was sound asleep and that's what jarred him awake was the gunshot. Hmm. So it's very, and again, he is, you know, he's the one where that story is very different from the one he's told before that and the one he told before that. And then later he's like, nah, none of it was true.
And he was a kid. He was just a kid, right?
Yeah,
very susceptible to someone being like, are you sure it didn't happen this way, maybe?
He was a 12-year-old kid that was traumatized because his mother and his aunt had just been, you know, he walked into them, into a horrific. I only put one crime scene photo up of that because I have to. In order, like when we do the episode on the house, I'll put up more, but I have to redact out the bodies out of all of them. But I redacted. So if you look on the website and see the one picture, you'll see the redacted out body. And when I do that, the reason it takes so long is I don't just block it because I want you to get a feel for it. So I actually like trace out the shapes of where the bodies were at and then black them out so that you can still see. But that's Amp's body that is redacted out of that photo, just to give you an idea of where it was at. But I mean, he walked into just chaos.
Yeah.
And he's 12. So yeah, very easily susceptible to suggestion, it turns out.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things came up for me as well when you were sort of describing this part of it. One thing was, I'm going to be so interested to hear if Willie testified to anything being talked about in his conversation with his brother, because if there was some big argument, two people came over and were arguing with this kid's parents, you know, was anything said to Willie? Like, there was ostensibly a phone call that happened in between a big argument and those same people coming back and murdering his family. So
we are going to get into Willie and his statements and testimony later.
Yeah, I figured. And then also just the kind of I'm very interested to hear a further breakdown of timing and just the dispatch logs versus what, you know, Larry thought was the time. And because I guess what's hard for me about that is, like, once you know that someone is manipulating Larry's story, then it just is hard to know which part of it has stayed untouched and is Larry's true account versus, like, what someone wants him to say. So I don't know what I'm saying there other than, like, well, Larry says he called the police immediately after the murders happened, but we only know that. I mean, isn't it possible? I don't know why this would be, but it could be possible that the murders could have taken place earlier if Larry is the only witness to the gunshots. And then for some reason, you know what I'm saying? Like, it just gets into that mode of, like, oh no, what do I trust about which story, a story that is going to be proven to me to be manipulated anyway?
Yeah. So again, there's obviously going to be a whole episode just on Larry. We'll get into that. But just to one thing I do want to correct is I called it a dispatch log that I put up. It's not the dispatch log. It's a log of people being on scene. So it's a little like, so the times are still accurate when, like, Trevino, the first arriving officer, got on scene, but that's not from dispatch. That's a log that was kept at the crime scene. And the way that would be generated was they would call dispatch, because when he got to the scene, he would call dispatch and say, I'm here, I'm on scene, to get all those times. So just to be clear, that document is not a dispatch log. It's a crime scene log of when people got there. But what's interesting is, and I'm working from memory now, it's not right in front, but I think it was like 2:26 or 2:28 a.m. or something he got there. And I think the call came in it was testified to at 2:26 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Weirdly, and again, we're going to dig all the way into all of Larry's stuff later. But weirdly, in the initial statement from Larry, he said, and we don't know where, it's not recorded, but he said that the murders happened at 2:05 a.m. There's no context whatsoever as to where 2:05 a.m. came from.
Hmm.
But if that's the case, then there was like a 21-minute delay between when the murders happened and when he called 911. But I don't know if 2:05 is accurate. If it was like, I heard a shot and I looked at my clock, I don't know. It's a weird thing that number just got pulled out.
Hmm.
And then you wonder, like, what's going on for 20 minutes? But then again, you know, again, he's 12 years old.
Yeah.
You know, like, what would you be doing for 20, like, walking out? His mother was the only one that was still alive, unconscious. But, you know, there was, you know, get into all this later, but there was agonal breathing. She was, even when Trevino got there, she was the only one that was still breathing a little bit. Like, you can see how he would be overwhelmed by that. You know, little one-year-old Katrina was still on the couch screaming. Like, all this stuff was, there was chaos going on at the time. But we'll get into all that later. But yeah, I just thought that time I mentioned was 2:38. Yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, Danielle said in the chat, 2:05 is so specific. Like, it is. And I don't know why. And also, it seems if it was 2:38 was the time, and again, I don't have that document right in front of me right now. Yeah, that seems like, you know, over 30 minutes seems unreasonable amount of time to be waiting to call 911. But I don't know. We'll dig into all that later.
Yeah. I also thought it was interesting. I mean, I don't know, but you just kind of mentioned that unbeknownst to the killers, Larry was in that back room. And
right.
In my mind, my first thought was, well, how well did they know these folks? Because Larry was in his room, right? I mean, he lived there. So it was just interesting to me that, like, did these people not realize there could be another witness?
Possible they did know, yeah.
And maybe they just didn't care or what. But because, you know, that could tell you something about, like, the victimology. It could tell you something about the killers if there's something they didn't know. It just reminded me of almost like the Becky Pinion Pines thing. Like, if they don't, if they didn't know that family, then they wouldn't necessarily know at all that there could have been a third person upstairs, versus these people have a personal beef with this family. So they should very well know that there might be a kid in the other room. And obviously they didn't harm the baby other than the absolute horrible trauma of, you know, being in the house.
I was going to say, like it would not. One thing we know about the offender is they certainly wouldn't have been bothered by the fact that Larry was in the back room, because they weren't bothered by the fact that there was a one-year-old laying next to her mother.
Right. Other than that, a 12-year-old makes a very different witness than a 1-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Kathy says, did I hear right? He became a suspect because Liz wrote Chris on a paper with a phone number. And then a 12-year-old who didn't know Chris Bynum said he heard him arguing with adults in the home. But Larry never said he saw anyone, just heard voices.
So we're going to get into a little bit of that more in this Sunday's episode. It's unclear. There's also a tip that we're going to get into. And on the surface, it seems very much like they backed into this, right? So, you know, they again, this is one of the most complex, confusing cases I've ever come across. And these cops solved it in less than 24 hours. You know, it seems unfathomable, doesn't it? So, but they have supposedly this tip, right? They get Chris in there, they get him to confess, and then his confession doesn't fit any of the evidence. It's impossible. The way he, you know, they finally got the story they got him to tell, and then the second story they got him to tell, also impossible. But then it's just like so many other cases we have. But then, well, there's all this other credible evidence. Like there was, Michelle saw a paper that Liz had wrote that said Chris on it, except for we don't have the paper and we don't know what the phone number was. It's not in evidence. That's just a thing we're saying happened. And then, and the big thing that we're going to get into this week is Larry saying that Chris did it. And that's a detail we're going to get into this week, because that also just doesn't seem very credible.
Yeah.
And you'll see why.
Yeah. Colin says, Bob, can you or will you be able to be telling us about the reputation of the detectives and DA who were involved in this case? Have they been involved in any proven wrongful conviction cases?
Yeah, we're definitely going to get into that later.
Okay. Jen says, I know you said this is a 30,000-foot view, but are we sure the police were even looking at this? It feels like they threw a dart at a suspect board and said, yep, good enough. Great job, guys. What a mess. And it's only the first episode. That ties back in, of course, to what you were talking about with Kathy's question, mm-hmm. where this is going. Kristen says, how far apart are the two crime scenes?
They're about a mile apart. It's, I mentioned earlier that Valeria had done like a Google map. And I think it's a 19, according to Google Maps, from the ballpark to the house, is a 19-minute walk or a 4-minute drive. It's just, they're just kind of around the corner of each other, about a mile apart.
Like roughly the same like neighborhood?
Not really, because yeah. it's a pretty densely populated area. Mm-hmm. So like yeah, but I mean, imagine, so if you wanted to walk to the ballpark and it's about a 20-minute walk to mm-hmm. get there.
Okay.
You know, so it's a fair distance. That mile is as the crow flies.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say, that seems like a long mile. Okay.
Yeah, it's probably closer to 2 miles walking distance.
Okay.
But yeah, so if you were, like where I live, if something's a mile away, it'd still be like, yeah, it's still kind of that neighborhood.
Right.
But in a very densely populated urban area, like, no, those are very different places.
Understood. Brian says, do we know if any ballistics from possible bullets found to be matching the same .38 caliber weapon can link both crimes? And did Chris Bynum own such a gun?
You're not going to believe this, but we're going to get into the forensics later.
Shocking. Shocking.
All that stuff.
And then that ties into questions from Jenna and Sarah. I'm sure you'll get into this going forward, but can you talk more about why the police thought the two crimes were connected? Was it really just that both were shootings? Going back to Brian's question, using that .38, were there any other connections? And I was just going to say that while I don't know the answer to that, one other little Easter egg that you drop, I guess it's not an Easter egg if you're not trying to hide it, but that you dropped at the beginning was you said there has been another confession for the quintuple homicide. So for me, I really perked up at that because I was like, wait a minute, if these crimes aren't connected, if we find out the crimes aren't connected, why did someone else also confess to killing these five people?
All very good questions. And I think this is a perfect spot for me to wrap things up and see what we're doing
okay.
on Sunday.
All right.
So here's the thing. This is very complicated case, obviously. 5 victims, 2 crime scenes. We can even throw Michelle's house in as part of that. This case was brought to us as a quintuple homicide, which is why it was presented that way in the first episode. But what we don't do here is accept the accepted narrative. And we don't make assumptions. So I am approaching this case from ground zero, as if I was the initial investigator, which is what we always do. And if I'm the initial investigator, I'm going to investigate one crime scene thoroughly, investigate the other crime scene thoroughly, and then figure out if they're connected. So I don't know if these two cases are connected yet. And we're going to start that process on Sunday when we do a deep dive into crime scene number one, the crime scene at Larry's house. That's coming up in 2 days on Sunday. Make sure you tune into that, and then we'll talk all about it next week.
Thanks, everybody. And bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.